This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Robert Brenner. He does tours of Times Square in New York City. Robert Brenner, it is great talking to you.
Oh, it's great being here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilliter.
Hi, Bob. Nice to be on.
Howdy.
Robert, so you started doing these tours of the history of Times Square. And I think a good way to kind of start things off is you're a New York native, and
yes,
you spent your youth exploring that area. This was like back in the 70s. And that era of Times Square is sort of, it's famous for films like A Taxi Driver and Midnight Cowboy. Can you talk about your experiences growing up in New York?
Okay, I started, I was actually born and raised in a small town called Nyack, about 20 miles due north of New York City. But I started coming into Times Square first as a boy in the 1960s, then as a teenager on my own in the 1970s, and finally as a young adult in the 1980s, freshly moved to the city. I stopped coming in the 1990s, the Times Square that I knew and loved, or at least was morbidly fascinated by, had mostly disappeared. But there are still some bits and pieces if you know where to look. And that's really how I got started doing this walking tour.
Did you start this walking tour? Was this fairly recently?
I started this 2 years ago. And it happened pretty much by chance. I ran into some people from the Times Square Alliance, which is a business improvement district for Times Square. And they were curious about what Times Square was like back in the 1970s. And most of these were young people in their 20s and 30s who had maybe seen it in movies like Midnight Cowboy and Taxi Driver, but had no direct experience with Times Square from that era. And I said, well, I could show you. So I put together a little walking tour, and I had so much fun doing that. I started expanding the tour, doing more research, presenting it for things like Jane's Walk. Are you familiar with Jane's Walk?
No.
Jane's Walk is done every year in honor of Jane Jacobs. Basically, people give walks of their neighborhoods or neighborhoods that they're interested in. And I did one on Times Square in the 1970s. Finally, the tour was picked up by Untapped Cities. I told Untapped Cities about the tour. They were fascinated by the idea. And now I'm doing this on a monthly basis for Untapped Cities. In fact, the next tour will be this Saturday, January 14th.
So you do this, is this every Saturday?
No, I do this once a month. Usually sometime in the middle of the month. And sometimes it's Saturday, and sometimes it's Sunday. We're still tweaking the, you know, what's the best day of the week to do this. I prefer the weekends because, you know, more people are off from work. But I also prefer early in the morning. I don't know if you've had any experience with Times Square, but it can be extremely crowded in the middle of the day, especially as you get close to theater time. We usually do this at 10:30 in the morning.
Has most of the interest for your tours been from tourists, or locals who are nostalgic for that era?
Actually, a lot of locals, some of whom have had direct firsthand experience with Times Square in that period and are nostalgic for it. And others are, as I said, young people who have heard about it, maybe seen it in movies or TV, but really had no direct experience and are curious about it. So that's very gratifying. I like that locals, you know, want to come to Times Square for this tour. One of my issues with Times Square today is that it's a place where tourists go, but locals do not, which was just the opposite of when I was growing up. Times Square, when I was growing up, that was for locals, not for tourists. Now it's just filled with tourists.
And do you think the key issue is that Times Square has become too bland for locals, or do you think locals should go out there and experience it?
No, no, there was definitely a attempt, I guess a successful attempt, for better or worse, to quote-unquote clean up Times Square in the 1990s.
This is during the when Giuliani was mayor.
During the Giuliani administration, although I don't think he can take all the credit for it. But I say to people today, they took Times Square, which was a dangerous but exciting neighborhood, and turned it into a safe but boring neighborhood. And that's precisely why locals stop going and why tourists do go there.
I hear a lot of people say, well, yeah, it was dangerous, but it's become kind of bland, but now it's a safe, much safer place. Do you think it's possible to find that kind of balance to have a safe environment where you're not in danger from crime, but also preserve the character of the history of an area?
Yes, absolutely. Let's take the Deuce, 42nd Street between 7th and 8th Avenue, and that was sort of, you know, ground zero for Times Square in the 1970s. And the Deuce had the reputation for being, you know, the most dangerous block in New York City, quote unquote. Well, most of the crime was penny ante stuff. It was, you know, prostitution, drug dealing, pickpocketing, three card Monte games, selling fake Gucci handbags and Rolex.
Were you ever a victim of crime at some point or no?
I did have one teenager, no more older than myself, try and hold me up at gunpoint. But it wasn't really a gun. He just had his fingers in his pocket. And I was pretty sure he just had his fingers in his pocket. So, you know, I was a cocky kid. I said, what do you think I am, a tourist from New Jersey? And I just, you know, turned around and kept walking.
I was kind of under the impression that all that historic signage and businesses from the old Times Square were gone, but your tour actually kind of exposes that there still are remnants of that. But would you say it's not on the main strip, Broadway? It's sort of the site, more on the side streets?
A lot of it is gone. There are still bits and pieces of it if you know where to look. But more on 8th Avenue than on Broadway and 7th Avenue. 8th Avenue was always seedier than 7th Avenue.
Is that considered Hell's Kitchen?
The borderline for Hell's Kitchen is 9th Avenue. You know, so it's just east of Hell's Kitchen. But you can still, you know, Show World is still there. Thank God, and so is the Playpen and a few other businesses of that sort. There's also several strip clubs still in Times Square, although they keep a much lower profile than they used to. You know,
I've noticed that with like older strip clubs have very like extravagant like signage, while newer ones they try to keep it as discreet as possible.
Right, right. They have much more discreet signs, back in the day, they used to have hawkers outside the strip clubs. You know, step right up, show's about to start, live girls, just $5, show starting in 5 minutes, et cetera.
I've seen that in San Francisco on Broadway.
All right, right. I actually, you know, I lived in San Francisco from about 81 to 82. In the Tenderloin, so I saw a lot of that in San Francisco as well. I don't know what it is. I always seem to wind up living in red light districts.
Yeah,
I don't know what it says about my character.
I was recently in San Francisco, and I was in that area, the Tenderloin, and I posted some photographs. And it does. I've never been to New York actually, but I was thinking it does have that feeling that you get from watching those films, like Taxi Driver. And this is still, I'm talking about like the Tenderloin in San Francisco today. You still have that feeling.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I'm of the opinion that a big city needs a red light district. That's not a real city without a red light district. And that attempts to clean up the red light district are misguided.
With your tour, is there an explicit focus on sort of the adult entertainment industry aspect or on the sort of historic signage in general?
It's definitely focused on the adult industry. I mean, I talk about some historic buildings like the Paramount and the Times Tower and the McGraw-Hill Building and things like that and the Brill Building. But what I talk about is what they were like in my particular time period.
I know there's been kind of an overall decline in like neon signage. Are you familiar with the blogger Thomas Rinaldi from New York Neon? I had him on the show.
Yeah, I've seen some of his work. And that's one of my sadnesses. Times Square used to be filled with a beautiful neon signage, very, very film noir. Now these are kind of these big video displays, which are nice, but they're kind of generic. You can find those in any major city, anywhere on Earth. One of the things that was unique about the Times Square was just the amount of neon signage. And neon, I grew up watching a lot of film noir, so I have a soft spot in my heart for neon.
Yeah, and back to, like, I did mention, like, my trip to San Francisco. There's still a lot of that in San Francisco, in both that Tenderloin area, even Union Square, which I guess is, like, SF's equivalent of Times Square, and then also, like, North Beach. But what I've heard about New York is there's a lot of that remnants on, like, the side streets. Even some of the Broadway theaters on, like, 42nd Street, but the main drag is all, like, electronic billboards.
Right, right. Because electronic billboards are easier to maintain than neon. I think if you know anything about neon, it requires a lot of maintenance. And there's very few people who do that now, at least in New York City. There's one company called Let There Be Neon, which is down in Tribeca, that does a lot of the neon work, keeping it going. For example, there used to be a peep show called Peep Lamb, and the neon sign for that was repurposed as part of a tourism site, part of the site dealing with Times Square in the 1970s. And Let There Be Neon repaired the sign and got it back, returned it to all its lurid glory. That's a free plug for Let There Be Neon. I don't have any connecting with them, but they do good work.
Oh yeah, I think I heard about them through Thomas Rinaldi. Have there been any push for like a historic preservation of these original businesses?
Well, no. I mean, just the opposite. There's been a push to eliminate all the adult businesses from Times Square. Again, in a misguided effort to rid the city of a red light district. All it's really done is push, sort of sex-oriented businesses all over the city. They're no longer all clustered together in one place. They're now just sort of scattered across the five boroughs.
Based on your observations from living in San Francisco, how would you compare that to your experiences in Times Square in New York? You were in San Francisco around in the 80s and New York in the 70s, so there were sort of...
Yeah.
How would you compare the two places?
I was in San Francisco in the early 80s. First of all, the reason I was living in the Tenderloin was that's where I found a cheap apartment. But I used to go down to, I guess it's Market Street, where there were a bunch of old grind houses. Because I'm also just a big film buff, and that was a great place where you could see double and triple bills all day. And that's really, the appeal of a lot of Times Square and the Tenderloin in San Francisco was just sort of a film lover's paradise. The Deuce used to be lying with about a dozen different grindhouses where you could sort of pick and choose, which double or triple bill you wanted to see that day. And that's gone. That's been, wiped out by the home video generation.
Pilliter, do you want to comment on some of your experiences visiting Times Square?
Yeah. The first time I was in Times Square, or New York City. I was, I think I was 17. We went to actually go see Conan O'Brien, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was a really nice time. But
what decade was it?
I think it might have been 2009 or 2008.
Okay.
This was
okay.
just when he was about to leave, and now what we know as the Conan show. But yeah. I remember experiencing Rockefeller Center. But on Times Square, there was a restaurant called Maxie's, I think. And it's no longer there. And they would sell these sandwiches with cheese in them, where they would just get this little fork and they would put it through the bread and be like 5 tons of cheese in it. And it was a cheese sandwich.
Like a cheese steak or just plain cheese?
Just plain cheese, like a deli cheese. And Maxie's did that. And I was just, I found that so confusing. I just remember just feeling cheese all day after that and watching Conan. But it's no longer there, unfortunately. I've recently went back and I've actually looked this up online. It closed down. But Maxie's looked like a very interesting place, and I have good memories associating Times Square with that, as well as a music store too. I clearly remember there was a music instrument store. I don't know what it's called, but there were instruments in there. I remember my mom was talking to someone. The guy was like, "Oh yeah, Conan O'Brien is a good customer here," or something like that. Funny. And everywhere, whenever I come back to New York, we're always in that Times Square or Manhattan area. But yeah, New York City is fun. You just have to really, the first time it's very fascinating. There's so much to do. But next time you go back, everywhere you go is a unique place to visit. You'll never get bored being in that New York City area.
Okay, you were talking about Music Row, which is actually part of my tour, which is not specifically, you know, sex-oriented businesses, but there was one block in Times Square that was filled with music stores.
Yes.
Where you could buy instruments, repair instruments, rent instruments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that was a relic from the time when there was a lot of musical theater in Times Square and a lot of nightclubs. And when you had live musical theater, you had musicians and they needed instruments. They needed to buy them. They needed to rent them. They needed to repair them. Well, you know, most musicals these days, they use pre-taped music. And as for music clubs, most of them have moved out of Times Square. So the music stores have mostly packed up and moved out. As a matter of fact, that whole block is right now pretty decimated. And seems, you know, slated for demolition.
Oh.
With the Broadway theaters, a lot of them came in and replaced the sex adult industry on 42nd Street. Were some of those theaters originals?
Well, all of those theaters that were original. 42nd Street, let me give you a brief history of grindhouses on the dudes, because it's important for people to understand this. At the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of theaters opened up in Times Square. It was like the new theater district. It moved uptown from Herald Square. But these theaters, they fell on hard times during the Depression. Some of them switched from live theater to showing movies. Some of them became burlesque houses. Fast forward to the 1970s, they had all become quote-unquote grindhouses, meaning that they were showing these double and triple bills all day long and into the wee hours of the night, and sometimes all night long as well. Now, some of these theaters, since Times Square has been quote-unquote cleaned up, have been returned to their original purpose. The New Amsterdam Theater, for example. When I was a teenager, it was showing kung fu movies. Now it's showing, I think it's either Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin, one of these Walt Disney musicals. Why? The Disney Corporation paid for restoring that theater, and now they have exclusive right to show their musicals there. Same thing with the New Victory Theater. I always get a kick out of seeing this. The New Victory Theater today specializes in children's theater, but plays aimed at kids. But when I was growing up, it was the Victory Theater, and it was a triple X-rated movie theater that showed that showed films like, you know, The Devil and Miss Jones and Deep Throat and Beyond the Green Door and all that kind of jazz. Interestingly enough, before it was Victory, porno theater, it was Minsky's Burlesque. So it has, you know, this has this long sort of naughty sex-related history. I see all these parents today taking their kids to the new Victory Theater. I don't think they have any idea what kind of films they used to show in this theater.
Huh. What are your thoughts on, like, the hotel neon signage? I know there was a famous one called the Milford, but they renovated that and took down all the signage recently, a few years ago.
Well, I'm against taking down any neon signs, period. I think
they used to have neon, one. I'm sure you're familiar kind with it. It's like a giant M.
Neon's a unique American art form and should be preserved. What I would say is, you know, people say, oh, you're just nostalgic and you want to keep stuff that's old and you're against stuff new. No. I'm against generic. I'm in favor of unique. You know, I don't want to preserve something because it's old. I want to preserve something because it's special. And if you're going to replace it, I don't want to replace it with something. I don't want to replace it with something generic. I want to replace it with something unique.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, like even in the 80s, a lot of these different films like Blade Runner, they use neon like to portray the future.
Well, yeah, that would be very interesting. Of course, you mentioned a favorite film of mine. And you know what Ridley Scott did with that film, very interestingly, fused science fiction with film noir, which I don't think had been really done before. And so he basically took a hard-boiled detective novel and put it into the science fiction framework, which has a very unique look and feel to it, and certainly something that hadn't really been done before in the film. Of course, Blade Runner is based upon the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. So I guess you have to go back to Philip K. Dick. Yeah, certainly a visionary.
I remember recently I was back in New York City earlier this May on a field trip with the Asian club of mine in school, and I was with my girlfriend. I was more in the Manhattan area and not in Times Square. I was near the this Japanese bookstore. I always slip its name, but I really enjoyed walking from that location around, I think, the New York City Public Library, I think it was called. It was a very round, like, the architect was very old, especially in a very... It was rainy that day, so it was obviously dirty. And from that, we also passed the I think John Basquiat was in there. It was one of the right next to Nintendo World or something. Right between those, I thought it was a very interesting place during this play. It wasn't Times Square, but it certainly had a reflection of things from big corporation to materialistic things to old things and to the art galleries, as if every little location on this New York trip was a very special place you can walk in. I do remember there was a grand piano store right next to this Japanese bookstore, and you could see, like, would a millionaire just walk in that store and buy a grand piano for I don't know how much.
Well, I think you're referring to the main branch of the New York Public Library, which of course is a beautiful building and, you know, one of the gems of New York City, and I used to go there all the time. Right behind it, of course, is Bryant Park, and I tell people as part of this tour, when I was growing up. Bryant Park was an open-air drug supermarket, and people only went into Bryant Park for two reasons: to score drugs or to get mugged.
I just remembered the bookstore. It was called Kinakuya Japanese Books, but
yeah, I think I'm familiar with that bookstore. I'm a bit of a nerd. I do like Japanese bookstores. But anyway, the point is, Bryant Park has been, you know, greatly transformed, and it's certainly a lot safer these days. I can't deny that. I think last year there was a murder in Bryant Park, and what was unusual about this murder was it was the first one in Bryant Park in over 20 years. Whereas this used to be like a weekly occurrence, you know, drug dealers would, you know, kill each other over turf battles, or junkies would OD. There was always, you know, they were always pulling dead bodies out of Bryant Park. That doesn't happen anymore. So that's an improvement. But even the New York Public Library itself was not sacrosanct. I remember distinctly walking in on a junkie shooting up in the third floor men's room. Yeah. He just scored some junk in the park, and he was using the men's room to shoot up.
You were saying earlier 8th Street, which is about two blocks west of Times Square, is that still considered a dangerous area, or is that sort of a borderline like gentrification?
8th Avenue, not 8th Street. Very, very different. And no, it's a safe neighborhood. I mean, it's a safe street. Now there is some encroachment of gentrification. Actually, I tell people if they want to get a real feel for what Times Square was back in the day, go a little further south. 8th Avenue between 34th Street and 42nd Street still has some of the feel of the old Times Square. There are still peep shows there. There are still junkies there. There are still pickpockets there. So proceed cautiously. But if you want to get – and there are a lot of sort of marginal businesses there. So proceed cautiously, but if you do want to get some of the feel of Times Square, those are the blocks to walk on. Basically between Penn Station and the Port Authority bus terminal, they still haven't managed to completely sanitize those blocks. One of your guests mentioned restaurant. I don't have any. Experience with this Maxi's, but we do discuss on the tour various eateries that go back to the day. You may have heard we just lost the Carnegie Deli, famous Jewish delicatessen in Times Square, that just closed after 80 years of business. But we still have places like Tad's and Smith's Bar and Grill.
Tad's a steakhouse in San Francisco and Union Square, San Francisco, that still has the original signage.
Oh, thank you. Just confirmed a rumor for me. Because there used to be about a dozen Tad's in New York City, and now there's only one left. And there's been a lot of discussion about, well, is there any Tad's left anywhere else in the world? And I had heard rumors that there was a Tad's in San Francisco, but I did not know for sure. Thank you very much. I may have to make a trip to San Francisco just to eat at your Tad's.
I'm actually looking at old pictures of Maxi's here, and now from what I see, it's called Maxi's Deli or Bar Delicacy. It's some German word I'm looking at, and it's actually runned out, and there's like nothing there from previous and now, but I'm getting memories from it looking at it.
For your audience who may not be familiar with the Tad's experience, should I describe it to them?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Tad's was a low-budget chain of steak restaurants. It's where you went to go when you wanted a steak meal, but you didn't have a lot of dough. And what you got, and what you can still get, is it's a steak. It's not a great steak. It's not even a good steak, but it is a steak, and you can get the, you know, baked potato with it, and you know, salad, and for not a lot of bucks. And that used to be my go-to place when I was going to Times Square. You know, as a teenager on a budget, going to Taz was like big splurge.
Do you remember Bonds, and when did that close?
Yes, I remember Bonds. For those who don't know, Bonds was a men's clothing store, and they eventually closed in the 1980s and turned it into a punk rock club of all things. The Clash did a very famous series of concerts there, where they basically just played there for 2 weeks nonstop. Now and then the punk rock club closed, and then there was a not very interesting Italian restaurant there called Bond International 45. And now there's nothing there. It's all covered with billboards. I don't know what they're going to replace that with now. As a matter of fact, I used to include Bonds on the tour because, you know, at least the sign was still there. Now even the sign is gone, so I can't include it on the tour anymore. When I do the tour, I try not to focus on things that have been torn down. I try to focus on things that are still standing in one way, shape, or another. But the tour is very much a race against time. I've certainly had the experience of coming back, you know, after doing the tour last month and finding out, much to my chagrin, they torn down something else, and Bonds was an early casualty.
You know, also I think is interesting in New York City. What I've always found fascinating was the 99-cent pizza parlors, and I find that weird because everywhere else you seem to be paying $3 for pizza, but it's always, I see this everywhere, and they tell me, don't eat the pizza, there's pigeons in there. The same with the hot dogs. And there's this pizza culture, or at least you see this, and I've always been fascinated to actually go and eat 99-cent dollar cardboard pizza, huh. Especially when you hear about New York City pizza. When people say that, it's just a thin slice of bread, really cheap sauce, and cheese on it. Do you show any amusements, or is there any interesting pizza places in that area?
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of 99-cent pizza. First, let me say, New York City is the home of pizza. Pizza was invented in New York City. There's a whole range of pizzeria, from the cheap 99-cent pizza to the much more elaborate and much more expensive pizzeria. I do steer clear of the 99-cent spot. Although I know people who are partisans of that, who say, you know, I just want a damn cheap slice of pizza and I don't care about anything else. Not my cup of tea. I've thought about doing a walking tour of just pizzerias, because New York City is one of these cities where there is a pizzeria on every block, and everyone has a strong opinion about not just who makes the best slice, but what constitutes a good slice of pizza. Is it thin crust, thick crust, toppings, no toppings, traditional toppings like pepperoni, or more exotic toppings like, you know, crayfish. So you can get into endless arguments about this. But having said that, I don't have a good pizzeria that I recommend in Times Square. It's not where I would go for a good pizza. I would go down to the Village to get good pizza.
You were saying earlier that every city should have a red light district. Can you make your case for that for people who are... I guess some people don't like the idea or are uncomfortable with it.
Well, sure. Every city is going to have some sex industry. So your question is, do you want to spread it out all over the city, or do you want to concentrate it in one area so that people who want to have that kind of entertainment could go there, and people who don't want to have that kind of entertainment can avoid it? I think the latter is preferable. When they closed, all the sex businesses in Times Square, what happened was little sex businesses opened up all over the city. And people who, you know, previously had no contact whatsoever with sex-oriented businesses suddenly had like an X-rated video store on their block. Whereas before they were all concentrated in Times Square.
Can you comment on the place? Have you been to the red light districts overseas in like Europe and Asia?
I've been to Amsterdam many times, and I've been to the red light district in Amsterdam many times. And I would just like to point out that Amsterdam has a totally different approach to the problem. They're not trying to eradicate their red light district. They're not even trying. That's the opposite. Their red light district is a world famous tourist attraction, and busloads of tourists show up every day to see their red light district. And this is not just horny adults. So that's a contingent. It's mom, dad, the kids, grandmas. This whole family is going to this, just walking around and looking at it. Totally different approach to red light districts than what we have here in New York City or here in the United States. Here in the United States, everyone talks about, oh, it's a problem, and how do we clean this up? How do we get rid of this, et cetera, et cetera. I think it should be celebrated and preserved, and the people who want that can go there, and the people who don't want it, they just don't have to go in that neighborhood. They just, that's not their area, and it's pretty easy to avoid. Just as the other people in Amsterdam void their red light district, they're not interested in that.
You know, I think there are, of course, a red light district in Philadelphia, and I'm trying to recollect of what my experience near there was. And usually what you hear is probably from the negative. It's just a bunch of older, misguided people that have social problems or they're part of the ghetto. Yet at the same time, it seems that the red light district could be a good place or some kind of upper class place, depending how much money you can spend on it. I mean, certainly there must be a red light district for the wealthy people. I wouldn't know that. But what is the age range between people who go to these red light districts? Are these mostly people in their 30s or some subculture or from the punk culture or just, junkies? How do you make of that? And what are...
I think the age varies a lot. And I just want to digress a little bit. I just want to say it's probably impossible to create this sort of red light district that used to exist in the past just because of the internet. Let's be clear, and technology in general. Let's be clear. A lot of people went to Times Square because the only way to see an X-rated film was to go to a red light district like Times Square and go to an adult movie theater. Similarly, the only way if you wanted to read an X-rated book or magazine, you had to go to a red light district like Times Square and purchase it there. Well, fast forward to now. If you want porn, you could download it to your smartphone. You don't have to go to a quote unquote red light district. So a lot of the as a lot of the impetus for going there is gone. Similarly, if you are trying to find a prostitute, most prostitutes now advertise on Craigslist and other internet websites. So this whole idea that you had to go to this area for some sort of sexual encounter is greatly diminished. Having said that, there's something different, going to see a live topless show or a live strip club is very different from watching porn on the internet. So there's still some need for that, but not the way it once was.
I can't think of the name of the documentary off the top of my head, but Pilliter, do you know the one I'm talking about? Peter Sotos did this documentary about the red light district. I think it was either New York and San Francisco. And some famous, infamous like, pornographer?
Jamie Gillis. That was called Pure Filth.
Jamie Gillis.
Jamie Gillis had this thing. He was a pornographer in the New York area. I think it was On the Go or something like that. Where he, on the prowl. And he would go to these prostitutes and say, hey, would you do this and that? And they were extremely lewd. So there was this avant-garde writer named Peter Sotos who just got those writings of Jamie Gillis and put the raw transcripts to see how nasty it was. It's kind of shock art. However, there is some strange...
I am reading on Gillis's Wikipedia page. Gillis stated that in the 70s, he wanted his ashes to be scattered on Times Square. But then once Times Square was cleaned up, he didn't want his ashes contaminated.
Interesting. But it just shows you that Jamie Gillis was a part of that prostitution scene in New York, and there's certainly that weird culture that goes around it.
I'm not familiar with this documentary. Now I'm going to have to hunt it down and check it out. Certainly Jamie Lee Gillis was very active in porn. He was in a lot of porn movies back then. We had stars back then. Everyone knew the names of different porn stars, whether it was Linda Lovelace or Marilyn Chambers. Everyone knew who these people were. I want to say it was a very different world especially in the early 1970s. This was the time of what was called porno chic, where it seemed ever so briefly that porn was going to go mainstream. It seems hopelessly naive now, but people were really starting to think that, they were going to start giving away Academy Awards for, best oral sex or mainstream actresses like Meryl Streep would be doing hardcore porn. The boundary between porn and not porn would disappear. Of course, that didn't happen. By the end of the 70s, there was this backlash. The country turned much more conservative, and we wound up with Ronald Reagan for president.
I know the porn industry really shifted to the San Fernando Valley in the 80s, but prior to that was a Times Square. Did they also, was it just where they showed the porn, or was there also a production of porn there?
Oh yeah, there was a homegrown, definitely a homegrown porn industry. With different people shooting porn out of, clandestine studios scattered around the city. There was one very famous one on 14th Street at a sort of secret undisclosed basement location. But yeah, New York City had its own homegrown porn films industry. It also had an adult book industry. It had people grinding out books and magazines at the same time. All of that is gone now.
Do you think we'll see like a kind of revival in a neon signage in the future, or just with the tech? I mean, there's the technological issues, but just for the aesthetics.
Yeah, I think some people will always love neon, just as some people always love buggy whips, but it's only going to appeal to a minority audience. I'm always going to vote in favor of neon, but because of the practical issues, I don't see a big neon revival. I think best what's going to happen is they'll come up with some technology that resembles neon, but eliminates the maintenance issues, and then maybe you'll see this big resurgence. But barring that, I think it's going to be all these LED displays, which I just don't find as interesting. I mean, they could do amazing tricks and stuff like that, but it's kind of like watching a giant computer screen, and I get up and go out to get away from my computer screen.
You've written about skyscrapers in New York for the Huffington Post. Can you?
I've written more about preserving. I've written about super talls. That's certainly one problem. We see a lot of these giant buildings being built for the sake of tallness. Now I have nothing against building a tall building. But a lot of the apartments in these buildings are just being purchased as investments, and nobody actually lives in them.
You have people from China and Saudi Arabia, and they buy them up, and just let it sit empty there.
Right, right. It's it's basically a way to park their money out of their home countries in case, you know, as a hedge in case something goes bad down in their country. You know, they're nice and safe here in the United States. But so you have all these big towers that are sitting empty. Meanwhile, New York City, as always, has a housing shortage. I want to come up with an app called Air Squat, which would hook up you know, homeless people with these empty apartments, and they could just, you know, go in and stay in these apartments while the owners are away. And of course, if the owners ever came back and ever actually wanted to stay in the apartment, they'd have to move. But in the meantime, it would reduce the homeless problem in the city.
Yeah, I mean, if there was legislation against it, it would really ease the housing costs in like cities like New York and San Francisco.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of tax breaks and there's no laws against it. So, you know, it's what the market will bear. About the only good thing is that the market for these super tall luxury towers appears to be collapsing. And so hopefully they won't build anymore, at least not in the near future. But you had texted me about an architect who had built a hotel in Times Square.
John Portman, the Hyatt. I think it was a Hyatt.
Right, the Hyatt. And I said, you know, I'm not a big fan. So I want to expand upon that a little bit. When the Hyatt was built in 82, it opened in 85, but in 82 they demolished 5 theaters in order to put up the Hyatt. And if you've ever seen the Hyatt, it's sort of this big monolithic building, you know, example of, you know, sort of brutalist architecture and design, so you can have like this totally self-contained experience. It has its own theater, its own restaurants, its own conference room. It's basically so you never have to leave the hotel, and you can just stay there for your entire visit to Times Square. Well, you know, if you're going to spend your entire visit inside your hotel, you know, what's the point? Why are you coming to Times Square? But this building, this was kind of like the first shot in what was eventually going to be the cleanup or purge of Times Square. About the only good thing I could say about this building is that after it went up, the Landmark Preservation Commission woke up and they immediately went out and landmarked 22 different theaters in and around Times Square because they saw the handwriting on the wall that unless the theaters were landmarked, they were just all going to be demolished and turned into hotels. I think you mentioned Conan O'Brien. I remember David Letterman saving the old Ed Sullivan Theater. You know, the Ed Sullivan Theater isn't in Times Square, but Ed Sullivan went off the air in the 1960s, and in the 1970s, that theater was mostly empty, and people were talking about, oh, let's gut it and turn it into office space. And the only reason the Ed Sullivan Theater, which is an historic theater and a beautiful theater, is still here today, is that David Letterman, when he decided to do his show, said, I want to do it in the Ed Sullivan Theater. So he changed late night TV and saved the Ed Sullivan Theater. But a lot of theaters have not been that lucky, although the Landmark Preservation Commission has landmarked a lot of theaters. The only theater on the Deuce that's landmarked inside and out is the new Amsterdam.
Is the new Amsterdam the only surviving of the original?
It's the only one that has been completely preserved, and that's because it's the only one that's completely landmarked inside and outside. Most of the others were at best only partially landmarked or not landmarked at all, and have either been demolished or greatly modified. And you know, to me, that's a pity and a shame.
I'll comment on what you were saying. That was terrible that they tore down all those theaters to build that hotel. And I can't really speak about that hotel, that one in New York, because I haven't been to that. But my commentary was more, I was like a big fan of the Embarcadero complex in San Francisco, which Portman designed. But I can't really comment specifically at the place in New York because I haven't been there. But there, you were kind of talking about.
I can't comment on the Embarcadero either because I don't remember it.
Yeah, but you're kind of talking how there's this kind of like some people they want to stay in their hotel all the time, or there's some people who kind of like want to go out. I can kind of comment on my trip in San Francisco. Like I kind of enjoy the variety. Like I can walk around like places like the Tenderloin, but I can also go to the Embarcadero Center, and it's like this self-enclosed kind of like retro-futuristic city with all these like courtyards and atriums, and so I can sort of I can appreciate both. Like I think they can coexist.
Yeah. Well, again, I can't comment on the Embarcadero. I will say my other issue with the Hyatt, it's just too damn big. It dwarfs all the buildings around it. Times Square, the buildings used to be 2, 3, 4 stories tall. It's now this sort of inhuman scale, which you know I don't think is a good environment.
What is the name of that building in Times Square? It's like an older high rise with like the neon clock. I think it was built like in the 20s.
Are you thinking about the Paramount?
Oh yeah, that's the one.
Okay, so this is another historic building that was built at the beginning of the 20th century. But what was interesting about the Paramount was that it had the Paramount Theater. And the Paramount Theater was a live music venue. And everyone from Bing Crosby to Frank Sinatra to Elvis Presley to I think even the Beatles performed at the Paramount at one time or another. I think my mother used to go there to see Frank Sinatra. But in the 1960s, it was gutted and turned into office space for the New York Times, of all things. And so they wrecked this beautiful classic theater with a lot of music history behind it, and turn it into office space. Now, ironically, in 2000, the World Wrestling Federation of all organizations, now known as World Wrestling Entertainment, took over the lobby and restored the marquee and created a quote unquote rock and wrestling club in the former Paramount Theater.
A replica of the original.
Yes, yeah, it is a reproduction of the original marquee, but they, you know, based on old photographs and architectural drawings, but at least they restored the marquee. Now, this is not as strange as you might think. Madison Square Garden used to be located in Times Square, not over at Penn Station. So you used to go to Times Square to see professional wrestling matches. So it's not so strange to have a rock and wrestling club in Times Square. And there's a place where wrestling fans could mingle and watch matches on closed circuit TV and occasionally get autographs from wrestlers. This turned out not to be one of Vince McMahon's better ideas. And it folded after a couple of years, and now it's a Hard Rock Cafe. At least the marquee's been restored.
I just think it's funny because when I think of wrestling, I think of really old like Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, or like Madison Square Garden, something really corny. Actually, I was going on that thinking about that.
Well, you know, professional wrestling's been around a long time, going back. At least in the 50s, and before that, you know, the first big TV star, or one of the very first big TV stars, was a guy named Gorgeous George. And Gorgeous George was a professional wrestler. And he was sort of the Hulk Hogan of his day. Everyone knew who he was. and wrestling was a big thing on TV. And matches at the Garden, which was on 8th Avenue between 49th and 50th Street, was a big thing. You go to the Garden Saturday night to see a wrestling match. Of course, professional wrestling is still, you know, still exists today, but it's no longer in Times Square. One of my dreams is to bring wrestling back to Times Square, or at least MMA fighting. You know, that's I guess that's the current equivalent. It's just something that I think belongs in Times Square, not in Penn Station. In addition to doing Untapped Cities, I also do a Times Square walking tour. I also do a 34th Street walking tour for the Municipal Arts Society of New York. And part of that tour, we discuss Penn Station and the destruction of the original Penn Station in 1964 and the building of Madison Square Garden in 1968. Yes, sir?
I heard they're talking about building a new station at the post office, but they're kind of emulating aspects of the original Penn Station, but it's like nothing like the original.
Right, right. The original Penn Station was opened in 1910, designed by McKim, Mead, and White, and the same architecture firm also designed the post office, which opened in 1912. And so around 2000, people started floating the idea, well, maybe since we knocked down the original Penn Station, maybe we could turn the post office into the new Penn Station and call it we're going to call it the Moynihan Station. Well, this idea was really moving forward until 2008, when a couple of things happened. First, the financial crisis hit, so a lot of money for this project dried up. And then a guy named Elliot Spitzer, who was governor at the time, he was a big proponent of this plan. But then he got into a little trouble and he forced to resign. And as a result, the whole project fell apart. Now, Governor Cuomo is trying to revive bits and pieces of it, but he's taking a very timid approach so far. We'll see if he gets more courageous. But the centerpiece of any plan is you have to move Madison Square Garden, because it's really on top of where the old train station was, and it's really an impediment to redeveloping Penn Station. So my idea is to put it back in Times Square. I don't think anyone else is enthusiastic about this idea, but that's where I think Madison Square Garden belongs. Put it back in Times Square.
You posted this thing on Facebook, this article from Crane's New York Business, and it says one of Times Square's biggest retail blocks hits the market. But I see this proposal for, I think it's West 42nd Street, and it just looks like this really like awful, bland shopping mall type thing. Like, what is it going to replace if this were to be built?
Right, right. When they got rid of a lot of the, you know, grindhouses and porno theaters on 42nd Street, what did they replace it with? Well, you know, kind of low rent businesses like, you know, Chevy's and Dallas Barbecue and things of that sort. Now they're saying they want to replace what is basically a low-end shopping mall with a high-end shopping mall. And my reaction is, I don't want it to be a shopping mall, period. I want to bring back some of the glory of the Deuce. There's a perfectly good theater sitting there called the Times Square Theater, and it's been sitting there dark since the city took it over in the 1990s. And nobody's doing anything with it. I'd like to see the establishment of a theater that what I call the Quentin Tarantino Grindhouse Repertory Movie Theater, that would just show nothing but Grindhouse films and double and triple bills nonstop, just like they did back in the day, to give people some experience of what Times Square was really like back then. I think that would be much much more interesting use of this space.
We did talk. We're talking about the skyscrapers. Do you have like a personal favorite skyscrapers in New York? Would you say like the Art Deco ones?
Well, no. Let's be clear. I don't favor any particular style of architecture. You know, I was making fun of this, the Hyatt Hotel, which is an example of, you know, bad brutalist architecture. But there's a wonderful example.
I like the Transamerica Pyramid in San Francisco, and that's kind of, I don't know if you call that brutalism, but it's kind of like 70s futurism.
I like it too, because part of it is, you know, when I went to San Francisco, that was part of San Francisco. But there's a wonderful new concrete storage area for salt that's used by the sanitation department. That's been built along the highway and in Tribeca. And since it's become kind of a fancy neighborhood, they had to build this kind of futuristic-looking concrete bunker for the salt, and it's actually quite beautiful looking. So I'm not devoted to any one particular style. I like Beaux-Art. I like the Art Deco. I like good brutalist architecture. I just don't think the Hyatt fits that category. I like good international architecture. And the problem with the international style of architecture, it just people copied it over and over again, and you know the imitations are just never as good as the original. So no, I'm not bound to one particular school of architecture or one particular aesthetic. Again, I'm all about the unique and against the generic. When people just start, you know, copying a style and just, you know, trying to replicate it over and over again, that's when you get into trouble.
I forget what it was called, but there was some complex at a Columbus Circle before the new development that was kind of in the international style.
Yeah, I've forgotten that too. That's been a troubled building. That was one of the uglier buildings. Just never really gelled. I'm blocking on the name of the building. Do forgive me. But you know, at least that building had a unique identity, had a unique character. Whether you liked it or hated it, it was, you know, it had an identity. That's very important. I'm against cookie cutter.
Oh, okay, it was called the Colosseum.
Oh, the Colosseum. I'm thinking of a different building. And yeah, you know, that was sort of the precursor of the Javits Center. It was a convention center, but it was kind of small, and it was kind of in the middle of the city. And they wanted to build something bigger, someplace else. That's really all it is. The building they replaced it with, I don't find particularly interesting.
Oh yeah, it's all like kind of the glass one. I think what they're doing is they're building these really tall, skinny towers because they're running out of space. That's one of the reasons.
Well, what is happening is one thing is that Bloomberg, that's Mayor Michael Bloomberg, in his final term in office, jammed through some zoning changes that allowed you to build taller buildings on smaller plots, essentially. And part of it because we're like breakthroughs in technology that will allow you to do something like that. You didn't need this, you know, sort of big footprint. I mean, you look at the Empire State Building, which opened in 1931. You see, it has this sort of huge footprint that's like half a block, half a square city block, in order to support this tower. Well, with zoning changes and improvements in technology, you don't need that kind of big footprint for a super tall.
I mean, I could see the kind of practical thing, but I prefer like the skyscrapers that have the nice large a footprint, like the Empire State Building. I even like a lot of the stuff from the 60s.
I like the classical lines of the Chrysler Building, of the Empire State Building, of the McGraw-Hill Building. Which we do cover in my Times Square tour. I just think they're nice proportions. I just think they're aesthetically pleasing. And I think, you know, one of the problems with the super talls that we see going up around the city right now is that just the proportions are wrong. They are
some of them are even, like, I think a skyscraper should be symmetrical. A lot of these new skyscrapers are actually asymmetrical, which is odd.
Well, I don't mind lack of symmetry. I mean, some of the breakthroughs in architecture, which allow, you know, non-traditional structures that are, you know, aren't all straight lines, some of those could be quite interesting. But again, a lot of these super talls are just being built to make them as tall as possible, and they have no other qualification.
We are getting towards the end of the show. Robert, is there anything... Would you like to plug your tour one more time and tell everyone in our audience why they should go out and take your tour?
Okay, so this tour is called Gritty Old Times Square, doing it for Untapped Cities. We do it once a month. The next one is this Saturday. And why should you do it? Well, you know, this is a part of rapidly disappearing New York. New York is changing, and it's not necessarily changing for the better. We're going through a period of hyper-gentrification where a lot of old, you know, mom-and-pop businesses are disappearing. And you should see what Times Square looked like before it was cleaned up. There are still remnants of it, but there's less every day. And if you want to see it, and not just in movies like Taxi Driver and Midnight Cowboy, as fine as those movies are, this is your opportunity to do it. In a couple of years, even these remnants, I fear, will be gone, and they'll just be part of history. And because they're part of the seedy side of history, you're not going to see a bunch of plaques put up about them. They're not going to be in tour guides and whatnot. They're just going to cease to exist. They're just going to disappear.
And stop using the internet and go out and buy porn at those shops.
Well. I don't know if you want to stop getting your porn on the internet. I'll leave that to each individual. But it's good to get up away from your computer screen and go out into the real world and walk around. I'll leave it at that.
Robert, would you like to be on in the future to talk about your articles on artificial intelligence?
Sure, sure. I've got a big mouth. I'm happy to talk about any and all of the above subjects.
It's been a great show. I would like to thank Robert Brenner for being on. Check out his tour.
That's Untapped Cities, Gritty Old Times Square.
And also thanks, Pilliter.
Thanks, Bob, for being on. I really enjoyed talking to you.
My pleasure. Anytime.